Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Before we begin with our panel, I'm very pleased to present to you, to enjoy for your viewing pleasure, a short documentary that will show you everything you want to know and very much inspire you, I believe, about Flossie Lewis's brief but spectacular take on growing old with grace. Please enjoy this.
Getting old is a state of mind. Now, I'm 91. I'm badly crippled. But I still think I'm 15. Will this go viral?
We hope so.
There are several ways I keep myself stimulated. I write light verse for The Crest, which is our newspaper. And every month you can find a sly little bit of verse from Flossie Lewis. The other way I keep being stimulated is just watching politics. And if that isn't enough to drive you crazy, I don't know what is. You do struggle to keep yourself neat and clean and fashionable. And there's always the possibility that romance comes your way. And just liking someone is a treat. Because part of being old is to get cranky. There's indigestion and your teeth fall out, and suddenly you need hearing aids, and you feel increasingly unattractive. And then somebody says, "How nice you look today, Mrs. Lewis," or "You're a real kick, Flossie," and you feel good about yourself, accepting the fact that the body is going to go, but the personality doesn't have to go. And that thing which is the hardest to admit is that character doesn't have to go. I'm Flossie Lewis. This is my brief but spectacular take on growing old.
Welcome to this special episode of Brief But Spectacular. I'm Steve Goldblum. The clip you just saw of Flossie Lewis first aired on PBS NewsHour in 2016, and as she predicted, it did indeed go viral. More than 7 million viewers watched her take on growing old and living well, and Flossie was a little overwhelmed by all the attention. She called me and asked if she was expected to respond personally to each of the thousands of comments on Facebook. I assured her that she was not. Flossie's video struck a chord with millions, but one of the responses really caught our attention. It came from author Daniel Handler, aka Lemony Snicket, who wondered how we managed to track down his high school English teacher. We soon heard from other Bay Area residents who passed through Flossie's classroom, and not just passed through, but who described the experience as having a profound effect on their education and their appreciation of language.
She was the best English teacher.
She demanded excellence.
She had this gravitas about her.
I think she has the ability to startle. She has no time for your bullshit.
So based on popular demand, we took a deeper dive with Flossie. We spent some time with her in her retirement home in Oakland, and we even organized a reunion to take place inside her old classroom. We invited many of her former students, some of whom she hadn't seen in 40 years. Flossie got right to work. She prepared a lecture for the occasion on whether or not Bob Dylan was worthy of the Nobel Prize for Literature. That's really all the context you need for what you're about to see. Let's start with an introduction. Tell us where you were born.
I think I was born in Bensonhurst, which is a section of Brooklyn. I received my BA from Brooklyn College, 1945. In the Jewish community of Brooklyn in the 40s, a girl was expected to be married, and the worst thing that could happen to her would be spinsterhood. And what was my fate? To be a spinster. So I got on a Greyhound bus, I went with a friend, and it took us 5 days and constipation to get to Berkeley. teaching was the one thing that a woman could do. I could command the attention of a class. I had a voice. I had that kind of personality that did not seem teacherly, but was provocative. What the kids liked was that I was crazy, unpredictable.
Were you scared when you left?
Oh, was I scared? It's another world, you just don't get it. If you were a girl in the 30s and the 40s, you could be a teacher, you could be a nurse, but you had to be married. And when I graduated, I looked like jailbait.
What do you mean by that?
I was little, small, and flat-chested.
When you got your degree from Brooklyn College, were people...
Impressed?
Not impressed.
No.
And they weren't proud?
No. My father told me that, he put it to me very bluntly. He said, "You're no bargain." My mother came to the graduation, and I said, "Mama, aren't you proud of me?" She said, "Yes, but if only you were a good girl."
Did they ever come to visit you in California?
Once I was married, yes. I was married to a very sweet man whose name was Jerry Lewis. He was a gifted musician. And the thing about Jerry was that he thought I was a real pain in the ass. And that was the makings of a very nice marriage. He died in 94. 45 years. And I miss him every day.
Do you find your acceptance or understanding of death has changed over the years?
Mm-hmm. Somebody's walking up straight, using a walker, breezily, happily. One little stroke, and they're like this.
Yeah. How long do you think you would like to be? How long would you like to live?
When the eyes and the ears go, no point after that. Yeah. You couldn't be in charge of the weather. We should have done this yesterday.
I think this works well.
Well, my philosophy is that everything that can go wrong will go wrong. Let's hope for the best.
Okay.
Now, Steve, are we on Ocean Avenue? I think we are.
I don't know.
Are we on Ocean Avenue, driver?
Not yet.
Because we used to go down Ocean Avenue. And we'd be there by this time. So when you go back by Ocean Avenue, please.
I think I was intimidated by her name. Flossie is a very unusual name.
Petite woman who always wore very funky clothes.
She had a command over the class, just as she had a command over the poetry and the prose that she taught.
She called me once when I was in college. I was very ill. I had just come out of the hospital. She read to me from Kafka's diary. She said, "This will cheer you up." I said, but it didn't go well for Kafka, though, did it? And she said, no, it didn't.
She changed the direction of my life. Because of Flossie, I became a writer. All throughout my life, Flossie's been there for me. Everyone else said no to me, and she said yes.
Wheelchair is in place.
It's in place.
This is the absolute shits. That's all I can say. It ain't no fun, but I'm delighted to be here, and thank you for coming. Jesus, how lovely. How lovely. Okay, ready? The trivial task before us is to decide whether Bobby Dylan is worth the laureate for literature. The people in Sweden were very clear that he spoke to several generations, but he doesn't speak to me. Defend his work or open my eyes to something that I haven't seen. And we don't have to go up and down the road, but speak.
What is wrong with Dylan, Flossie? I mean, he's just putting out the questions.
So he makes a search.
For some people.
By making that iconoclastic decision, you are opening up the world to future honorees.
Rena, dear, you're on, baby.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man is a rhetorical question.
Yes, I see what you're saying. John.
He spoke for a generation and he continues to speak. Strictly speaking, poetry, I am with you in terms of the structure.
John, dear, I will not dispute anything that I've heard. I know you love him. I happen not to love him. But that's not the point. He speaks for your generation. How do we decide who represents poetry? Honey, speak.
Whether he's a poet laureate, the question for me is compared to what?
Put him next to someone that also merits this kind of consideration and show me how he wins, and then we can give Dylan the Laureate Prize for protest songs. Don't give him literature. Literature is too big, but give him a prize. Michael, put it all together for us, my dear.
My goodness. I am inclined to give a rejoinder by way of an example. See if you can identify the source. We used to fuss when the landlord dissed us. No heat, wonder why Christmas missed us. Birthdays was the worst days. Now we sip champagne when we thirsty. I like that so much more for what it does for the English language. I personally am unequivocally opposed to Dylan being chosen as the Nobel laureate, but that doesn't mean that I'm opposed to the views that I've heard here. I feel borne aloft by what has been said before. And that's what was wonderful about your classroom, Flossie. It wasn't just your voice. You would bring us all in, and we would kick around the room like that.
I remember when you read us a sonnet from Shakespeare.
Yes.
And said, it's no good. And that was amazing. That
Thank
was amazing.
You for remembering.
I remember so clearly.
I remember my first composition that I wrote for you. Your comment was, I'm concerned by how drab your verb are.
When I was here in high school and coming out, I was depressed. I was kind of lost. I was maybe suicidal. I tell people, I had this English teacher who I think saved my life. And I think you did, so thank you, and I love you.
You really introduced me to poetry. I've gone on to become an architect, and I have a really strong affinity for classical Greek architecture. You've made those buildings come to life for me and shown me that architecture can have poetry. Thank you very much.
Okay, guys. The class is over, but I hope it will never be over. And I hope, even if the answers are blowing in the wind, that maybe having an answer that is too certain can destroy us also. Yes.
Bye-bye,
honey.
Bye-bye. Nice meeting you.
Oh, the cab is here.
Abby's here. It's the same man.
Tell him to go up Ocean
Avenue. Oh, boy.
You touched a lot of people, Flossie.
A lot of people touched me. It's a two-way street. Imagine teaching those kids. Going to go the way he wants to go. It's ain't going to be Ocean Avenue. What the hell? overwhelmed. I don't know what to do about all these hits. Does this enlarge your career a little bit, or do you always have such a response to your presentation? I don't know what the hell to do with all of this, but it's kind of nice. Get back to me and help me out a little bit. Bye-bye, Steve, but call me as quickly as you can. Okay, dear. Bye for the minute.
I know she's getting the standing ovation. Is there a dry eye in the house right now? Because nope. Someone promised me tissues. I don't see any tissues. All right. Well, welcome to the Commonwealth Club. Thank you so much for coming and joining us tonight. I need to tell you that you can find us online at commonwealthclub.org, Facebook, Twitter, and on YouTube. I'm Lauren Schiller, host of the podcast and radio show Inflection Point on KALW, and I will be your moderator tonight. We are joined tonight by three panelists, one of whom you've just gotten to know a little bit about. But we'll start with Steve Goldblum, who made this all possible. He is the creator of Brief But Spectacular, which is a series on PBS NewsHour, which invites all of us to spend a little bit of time in another person's shoes. This is an interactive evening, so for now I'd like to ask everyone to take off their shoes and hand them to the person on the left. Just kidding. Okay. Steve has talked with over 100 people, including many that you have heard of, Anna Deavere Smith, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Terry Gross, and these two women sitting here with us this evening, who are the most popular briefs that he has filmed to date. So, let me introduce them. Let's start with Flossie, you've just gotten a little bit of a taste of. She was an award-winning teacher, as you could see on the screen, with 6 decades of experience. She hailed from Brooklyn, but is now in Oakland. And some of her students that you saw just now are with us tonight. So, you guys want to, whoa, as I dropped my clipboard, do you guys want to say hello? I think you're over there somewhere.
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you for being here. So Flossie comes from Brooklyn. She now lives in Oakland. And to my left here is Mahogany L. Brown, who comes from Oakland but now lives in Brooklyn. She is an award-winning poet. She's also a professor, an organizer, and the author of Black Girl Magic, which we will hear tonight. We would love to hear your questions, so please write them down as you think of them, and a staff member will bring them up, and we will get to as many of them as we can. So, we just watched this excerpt from a short documentary about you, Flossie. How does it feel to see your name in lights?
It makes me feel like a fraud.
Oh. Why?
Because there were teachers who made me a teacher and colleagues who kept me honest. And I'd like to mention their names wherever they are.
Okay.
At Lincoln High School, Marion Shepherd. At Lincoln High School, Jeannie A. Eckloff. At Lincoln High School, I'm trying to think of a few more people, but they escape me now. At Lowell High School, Joanne Stewart, who is still with me, and we still talk about teaching and books. At Lowell High School, there was Maurice Englander. There was Barclay Bates. Thank you, Leanne Torlakson. Thank you, Gwen Fuller, and I've left out so many.
Always.
But for me to receive all the credit when I know that every name I mentioned was as good as I shall ever be, and I still hear the sound of Jeannie A. Eckloff's Middle English. Her Middle English was better than any prof that I ever had. She taught me the sound of Chaucer. And I'm thinking of Joanne Stewart, who is littler than I am, but packed as great a wallop. And I'm eternally grateful for what they taught me. And I'm grateful to this company because there is such a thing as teachers who aren't recognized. And there is such a thing as teaching. And I beg your pardon, there is such a thing as good books that deserve to be taught. I'm a little bit disenchanted with the internet. And of course, I don't like anything about Twitter.
Does anyone?
And not because our president is such a practitioner.
Of course she went viral.
But to think that we have come to the point where we accept Twitter as a form of composition is moving in the direction of Duck Speak in 1984. Thank you very much for the moment.
A cautionary tale. Well, Steve, will you tell us a bit about how Brief But Spectacular got started? What is it that you're hoping for when people see these glimpses into other people's lives?
Sure. Well, first I have to pick up on a theme, which is Flossie, about collaboration and credit. I'm up here, but there's other people I have to mention. Zach Land Miller. I don't know where he is, but where is he? There he is. My longtime producing partner from episode number one makes Brief with me, and he does about 15 different jobs in one. Melissa Williams, who runs my production company, Second Peninsula, and she helped produce this event and countless others. And lastly is PBS NewsHour, because if it's not for PBS NewsHour, nobody's up here. And two people I want to call out. Mike Rancilio is the general manager. He's here. And Sarah Just is the executive producer of NewsHour. And she commissioned and greenlit this show over 3 years ago. And I'm eternally grateful to you for doing that. So thank you. But the intention, as you said, was always to invite viewers to walk in somebody else's shoes. And we, in the beginning, felt a lot of pressure to book these big guests, a lot of people probably who like spoken at the Commonwealth Club. And so we went after Alec Baldwin and Ta-Nehisi Coates and Marina Abramović. And people were pretty excited to see them. But what has been heartwarming to learn from doing the series is to see the audience's overwhelming response to people that they didn't know. And the two best examples of that are Flossie and Mahogany. By the way, the two best names we've ever had on the show, Flossie and Mahogany. All the accident involved in how we met also melts my heart. I met Flossie completely at random in her retirement home. We were shooting a movie with Rita Moreno, and we literally bumped into her. And just knew she was an original force of nature. I said, will you talk to me? And she said, sure, I'll talk to you.
My understanding is that she said, now what are you doing here?
What are you doing?
Is that correct?
I think so. Who are you? Why are you here? So I explained myself. And then I had always wanted to interview somebody about life in their 90s. That had been something I'd wanted to do. And as we were talking with Flossie, Zach and I got this rush of adrenaline that you know as a journalist too, and I got the same feeling with Mahogany, which is, oh my God, people are going to see this. People are really going to see this. And it was halfway through the interview, we just looked at each other and said, we have to get out of the way, and we have to go home, and we have to represent this person's story. And that, and we just had a hunch that people were really going to spread this thing around, and they both reached millions within a day. And that just doesn't happen with every one. I'd like it if it did, but it doesn't. So that's what they have in common. They're both truly original voices.
So I wanted to ask you, Flossie, I mean, you have a platform now. You have a platform about growing old with grace. So now that you have millions of people viewing you and hundreds in this room, is there anything, not to put you on the spot, what do we all need to know? what is it you would like us to be aware of that we should talk about? Because nobody wants to talk about getting old.
I want us to be aware of how tyranny asserts itself, how it comes to be, And I'm thinking now of a book by Professor Stephen Greenblatt, who is one of my profs. The name of the book is Tyranny. It came out in 2018. There are lots of authorities on Shakespeare, but he's outstanding. Sometimes he's a little bit... He sells too many books, so that makes people suspicious. But it's worth the read. And in Tyranny, he takes the great tragedies that Shakespeare has written, starting with Richard III. Oh, it starts with Henry VI, although Henry VI was not a tyrant. But he goes through the great tragedies, Macbeth, King Lear, Coriolanus, and shows that the tyrant doesn't make himself. He needs enablers. He needs agitators. He needs people to push him. He needs people who whisper things in his ear. It may be a Steve Bannon. It may be a bunch of witches. The witch is in the eye of the beholder. The witch is in the self as well. And to think about that book and remembering Shakespeare the way I taught him is to make me a better teacher and is to make me able to say, look at what we have today. Who were his enablers? Who were his agitators? Why did they push him into the position he now occupies? And what's the answer to getting rid of him with some degree of our dignity? So I hope that answers.
Okay. So that is actually a great setup for Mahogany, because the role of poetry,
yes,
in telling the stories of the tyrants and the saviors and the angels and the devils and the truth, just telling the truth. You know, as a poet, I'm wondering, for you, Mahogany, do you ever have, like, can you feel a poem coming on? Like, how do you know when it's time to tell something through poetry?
I no longer write from inspiration only. For the past, I guess, 10 years, I've been practicing everyday writing. And just what does that mean to exercise the muscle as a writer? So the inspiration is, I mean, I write every day about everything. I'm writing about the cigarette lady in Brooklyn. I'm writing about the fact that it costs $15 to get to Staten Island and who wants to go there on purpose. I'm writing about... That's just like one
it's
way.
It's not 25 cents anymore?
No.
What happened?
All right. So I have these just like everyday moments, like you're talking about. You're writing history as it's happening, because, you know, the poets and the writers, those are the first historians.
Yes.
So the poem really happens when I read it into the space with other people, and I see how it affects them. And then I think, okay, so I've worked on the craft of it, and I know that it needs to be said, and now I know, like, I have to, like, finesse it and make sure that it can stand alone whether I'm here or not. So usually it takes two different settings. The writing is one, which I do every day for an hour a day, even on Twitter.
I knew it. I saw your face. I knew it. I knew it.
Okay, I will just say you're the one redeeming quality on Twitter.
I love it. But I can admit that, like, if you have a bad timeline, it can be trash. You know, you just have a moment where you're like, who gave you internet access? Net neutrality for everyone but you. I think when the poem hits the air, that's when I realize this poem is super necessary. Also, when I'm scared, I'm realizing that a poem is happening.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, Twitter isn't rap. Rap is authentic.
Sure.
Yeah.
I agree. I think Twitter is one of many. But I think if that's the only for someone, then that's where it's, you know, it's ready to be... It's tyranny. Like, it can't be your only source of information. Twitter is not the only news feed. It is one of many. But I found some amazing thinkers on there, and then it leads me into this great academic space. But I've also found some trash with verified marks that make you believe that this is the truth.
So, Mahogany, you and I are going to get together, and you are going to show me a Twitter poem.
Done.
Okay?
Yes.
That's a deal.
We're going to record it. That, too, will go viral. It's going to be good, too.
Perfect. That's our next episode.
I promise.
We'll be there.
It's that Brooklyn-Oakland thing, I'm telling you.
So... We want to show a clip from Black. We want to show the clip of you reading, or speaking, I should say. I'm reading Black Girl Magic. You're speaking Black Girl Magic. Mm-hmm. This poem that you wrote, which I would say actually reads two different ways. When I read it on the page and when I hear you say it, mm-hmm. the power in your voice mm-hmm. is so incredible, and everyone is going to get to experience this in a moment. Is there anything that you want to say about that poem before we show it? Which is a weird thing to say before we show your poem.
It speaks for itself.
Yeah. Okay, I agree. Okay, so can we play that?
They say you ain't supposed to be here, Black girl. You ain't supposed to wear red lipstick. You ain't supposed to wear high heels. You ain't supposed to smile in public. You ain't supposed to smile nowhere, Black girl. You ain't supposed to be no more than a girlfriend. You ain't supposed to get married. You ain't supposed to want no dream that big. You ain't supposed to dream at all. You ain't supposed to do nothing but carry babies and carry felons and carry weaves and carry silence and carry families and carry confusion and carry a nation, but never an opinion. Because you ain't supposed to have nothing to say, Black girl, not unless it's a joke. Because you ain't supposed to love yourself, Black girl. You ain't supposed to find nothing worth saving in all that brown. You ain't supposed to know that Tina, Beyonce, Cecily, Shonda, Rhymes, Shine, 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 Black girl. You ain't supposed to love your mind. You ain't supposed to love. You ain't supposed to be loved up on. You only supposed to pose voodoo child, vixen style. You're supposed to pop out babies and hide the stretch marks. You're supposed to be still. So still they think you statue. So still they think you chalked outline. So still they keep thinking you stone. Until you look more Medusa than Viola Davis. Until you sound more Shanae than Kerry Washington. Until you're more side-eyed than Michelle Obama on a Tuesday, but you tell them you are more than a hot comb and a wash and set. You are Kunta Kinte skin. You are a Black girl worth remembering, and you are a threat knowing yourself. You are a threat loving yourself. You are a threat loving your kin. You are a threat loving your children. You Black girl magic. You Black girl fly. You Black girl brilliance. You Black girl wonder. You Black girl shine. You Black girl bloom. You Black girl, Black girl. And you turning into a beautiful Black woman right before our eyes. Bravo. My name is Mahogany L. Brown, and this is my brief but spectacular take on Black Girl Magic.
Yeah. Ooh, I start sweating.
I know. yeah, it's brilliant.
Okay. That's like scary to watch.
On the big screen.
Yeah. That day was funny because I was late. Mm-hmm. And we did it in this library in Brooklyn at Pratt Institute.
We were going to JFK.
Yes.
And we almost didn't make it mm-hmm. in time. And we just got, and you gave us one take. And said, that's it.
Yes.
And I looked at Zach. I said, did you get it all? And he said, yeah.
He's like, do you want to do the other thing? I was like, no.
I mean,
we're done.
Yeah, you left it on the floor.
You know, this kid and I could have hit it off. There would have been.
So I... in Poetry Magazine, which a poet pointed me to, you called this poem a triumphant and explosive war cry. Mm-hmm. And in it, you're directly addressing Black girls, mm-hmm. Black girl. And but yet, I'm clearly not a Black girl, but I also feel like you're talking to me so that I can understand how it might feel. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, as you... let's talk about that poem specifically. Are you thinking in both those terms? Is it about, I want other people to understand where I'm coming from? Or is it about, I want you to know I know where you're coming from too? Or maybe both.
So I wrote that poem when I said War Cry in the Poetry Magazine essay. I was really speaking about how the poem came to be, which was going to these community rallies and seeing the mothers of the slain victims of police brutality stand up and be there for everyone. And they asked poets all the time to, share a poem. And a lot of heart-wrenching poems happen, but I just wanted a moment of redemption to say that I see you, and also I see myself, and also I see my daughter. And so when I wrote the poem, I was clear that I just wanted to have a moment of joy, even though, like, we are surviving trauma. Like, what does resilience look like? And I think when people who are not Black find joy in it, that is the moment of humanity, right? Like, that is when you're seeing someone see themselves, revel in themselves, and that is a joyous moment, and that's where our connection is. I'm not... The first thing I did wrong was look at the video and then look at the comment section.
No.
And so the first, it hurt my heart. The first thing I saw was like, what about white girl magic? And I was like, really? Like, you have America, mama. Like, you all right. You're good. You're good. We got 2 minutes. Hold on, 15 seconds. Like, give me this. But really, it was just the moment of... Here we are making space. Here I was trying to make space where it felt like there was none, right? And that's not true. If I'm honest, my pillars, we talked about this earlier, are Gwendolyn Brooks and June Jordan and Audre Lorde and Ntozake Shange. And those Black women writers made space for me to be able to even say that, to even find the articulation of what it looks like to love yourself when everything around you says don't. So... when I see people loving that poem and not being a person of African or African American descent, that is what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to show you what self-love can look like in a time where love is very hard to present itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, it worked for me. Awesome. Thank you.
Awesome.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Well, it's also interesting just you talking about, both of you talking about the people who come before you. And I will say that is one of the things that I do like about Twitter, is that it leads you to people you might not otherwise discover. Mm-hmm. So if I follow who you follow, mm-hmm. then I'm going to learn a bit more about where you're coming from. Mm-hmm. But I guess Twitter leads us to the question of polarization and difficult conversations and everyone getting into their own camps. And I wonder, I mean, this is really a question for all of you and whoever would like to answer it first. How do we have these hard conversations without being at each other's throats? How do we open those doors?
You start in the classroom. Mm-hmm. You start in the classroom where if the kids are going to tear at one another, you still have some authority to say, cool it. Mm-hmm. You start with a book that dares to touch on some of these issues. Mm-hmm. You start with a poem by Gwendolyn Brooks called Abortion. Mm-hmm. Where the Black mother says, I loved every one of you, but I couldn't feed all of you. And that's hard to take in the light of so many stereotypes, because Black women don't have as many abortions as white women do, and not alone because they can't afford them. So I think you start with the classroom. You start with books that you think not only should be read, but that you want to teach because you have something to say about them. Mm-hmm. And then you fight it out.
And how do you do that civilly? Because that's, I feel like, the skill that we all need to learn, is how to find the common stick to your point.
You fight it out by taking a stand and letting the kid fight back. Mm. And you do that not only by office hours. You do it through composition. You do it through writing. And sometimes you have to lose a battle. I think one of the things that I learned early was that some of the kids I was teaching were 10 times smarter than I was. And once I recognized that, half the battle is over.
I love that idea of it starts in the classroom. I agree. I facilitate poetry workshops around the world. And the one thing I always return to with the young poet is, I don't believe you. Like, if you're going to write this, be honest, right? Don't write what you think I want to hear. Write what actually needs to be
yes.
said. Yeah, and that's where the hard conversations happen, when you're willing to stand up and say this thing that's super difficult and may not be the pleaser for the crowd, but is necessary to start that pivot in how we deal with each other and how we change ideas and how we change movements. I love the classroom.
See,
writing.
You said, I don't believe you. Mm-hmm. And I would say, watch out for the passive voice.
Mm-hmm. That's why you're the teacher.
I have to say.
I see a co-teaching collaboration in our future.
I have to pick up on something Flossie said. There's two books you should all get. First is Black Girl Magic. They should buy your book. And they should also buy a book by Flossie Lewis that I found on Amazon called Getting Engaged, Falling in Love with Your Paper, which you wrote in 1984. Oh. And I got a copy of it on Amazon. And there's a stretch in the book where she, by the way, it's all brilliant, but there's a stretch in the book where she talks about falling in love, falling in love with your paper, taking your paper out to dinner, making love to your paper at one point. You said, and here's a line she says, this is directly to the student. I know you are sometimes stuck. You're tied to a paper you have to finish. You have this act to perform and you want to get it done as quickly as possible. I repeat, don't. It's so boring. It's so boring to pretend to love. It's such a drag.
Yes, it's so boring to pretend to love. Yes, indeed.
Yes. And kind of pointless, right?
Yeah.
Well, okay. So I want to talk about this point of authenticity and what you really feel, because I feel like we're living also in this time of totally curated personalities, mm-hmm. and that we all feel like we're not people anymore, we're brands. Mm. And we have to stand for something, and we have to look a certain way, and we have to be consistent about it, or we get yelled at by other people on the internet. Mm. How do you, I mean, this is maybe a personal advice question, but how does a person stay authentic in the middle of all that pressure to be, I don't know, something they really aren't, or that other people expect them to be?
Have a Flossie in your life.
Uh-huh.
Like you really need a good tribe, and that means who are your circle of friends? Who do you check and balance with? Sometimes I get caught in the hype, or you know, I could write a poem and I think, oh, this person said it's amazing, and then I'll take it to a friend. I'm like, what do you think? And they're like,
You need those friends, right?
And I'm like, They said it was great, but like, you need the circle of people who want you to push forward and be better. Mm-hmm. I think that's how you can be your most authentic self. And also Instagram, I feel like you feel about Twitter, I feel about Instagram, which is the curated yeah. brand, right? It's the perfect picture, the perfect filter. There's this filter and app now where you can do this and make yourself skinnier.
Yeah.
It's bananas. And of course, I was like, I just want to see, oh my God, like, I am a 2. That's insane. I deleted it, don't worry.
Does it work on like ankles?
It works everywhere.
Everywhere.
But okay. You look kind of like an ocean of a body instead of your actual, it's weird. But that said, I'm looking at those apps now and I'm thinking the best way to stay authentic is to be honest with like, our flaws and how we're changing. And you can love something today and not tomorrow. And you can like support someone and then find out they did something that is less desirable than humans need and say, mm-hmm. you know what, call that out instead of just, you know, strong and wrong. It's okay to be wrong. Like, it's okay to be wrong. I mean, if we say that 3 times a day, we will feel much better. But then you also have to meet the it's okay to be wrong with what am I going to do to make it better? You can't just walk in the wrong and it's like, oh, my flaws are so dope.
I'm out here harming people with my flaws. It's all good because I said it 3 times a day, so I'm okay. No.
Right. Just
once you accept
it.
That it's a flaw, like it's something that can be changed, then you have to accept the responsibility of, you know, how to make it better, how to do better.
That sounds like good parenting advice, too.
You know, I have a 20-year-old, so we have these conversations often.
Well, Steve, through Brief But Spectacular, it seems like you also have an opportunity to get past this sort of curated approach. It feels like when I see the stories that you produce, I feel like I'm seeing inside the person that is talking, that they really are presenting their true selves. How do you do that?
Well, that we're always searching for that answer. That's what we're always looking for. And we were really lucky to meet Flossie and Mahogany. But now we have a science that we're using to find our new subjects. And so one of the things that we're doing right now with Brief But Spectacular is looking at some of the leading issues in the country, like misuse of prisons, substance abuse, mental health. And we're going to areas in the country that are most underrepresented. And so to give you an example, last week Zach and I were in Tucson speaking with a young woman whose mother was deported, who raised her siblings and just graduated high school. Mm. We were the next day in Navajo Nation speaking with the lone female delegate on the Navajo Council about sexual abuse. The next day we were in Olympia, Washington, speaking to a mother whose son is incarcerated in 23-hour lockdown, has bipolar.
Oh, my God.
And we talked to her about the criminalization of mental health. By the way, we're only able to do this right now because of the Heising-Simons Foundation's mandate has been that we get outside the coast and tell these stories. And so what we're trying to do is plant a seed with people, find these original voices, and then come back to them. And so tonight, an example of that is Flossie. We wanted this set to create some conditions to show this woman in her element. Because it's one thing to hear about someone being a great teacher, which we heard about, but to really see her in action is in something else. So that's what we want to do with Brief But Spectacular now. We're currently looking to expand the show like that. And honestly, Mahogany, you're next. We're coming for you. we would love to see you.
She's ready.
I'm ready.
So we're actively fundraising right now for our show to really do what we want to do, which is tell these longer stories. We want these portraits across the country. We've been privileged to do 150 of them, but we want to take a deeper dive and keep going.
So we actually, on that note, we have a question from the audience that says, how will I know when I have a Brief But Spectacular moment? I'm in my late 60s and still waiting for it. Dear Steve.
Dear Steve? Okay. I have to say this because my parents are here. My wife is here. My dad's father is the namesake. When I was little, he lives in Nova Scotia. I would sneak out of synagogue, walk around the block, make it look like I've been there the whole time. When I came back, he would say, "Brief but spectacular." That is the name, it's true. His name is Dick Goldblum, and he's the 100th episode. We interviewed him on what it feels like to have memory loss or dementia, which he is experiencing now. So your brief but spectacular moment, the answer is, I don't know. Email me and make your video and make your voice known, because we'll know it when we see it.
But it feels like inside ourselves we should be able to recognize that too. You know, what does that feel like to know? Do you ever have a moment like that where you're like, this is it? Maybe
no.
It was Black Girl Magic.
No. I have the moments when I'm telling the story and someone goes, what?
Yes. Yes.
And you're like, oh, that's a lot. And they're like, how did you get out? And I'm like, I don't know. I just did this thing. And then I wrote this poem and they're like inspired. And I did not know that it was Brief But Spectacular. Black Girl Magic wasn't even the poem they asked me for. So that's funny.
That's right.
Yeah, you asked me for something else. And I said, I have this other thing I really feel good about. Can I do that?
Yeah, that's right.
So in the moment, I didn't think of it as like, this is it. I just thought, it's on my heart. I really want to share this. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it'll change someone's mind. And since it aired, I've received about 5 that I know of, to my personal account, 5 videos from 5 young girls, all ages 4th grade and lower. I don't know what age that is, but they like, eh.
Yeah.
And they use the poem in oratorical contests now.
and I literally am like bawling on the side of a freaking mountain. Watches like someone sent me, and I'm like, what is she doing? And then she starts this choreography, and she does like the voice, like when I say, you are this, and she does it, and I'm like, are you kidding me? This is amazing. I'm going to cry now. Okay.
Oh.
Well, right. I have to say, we were... We were typing. Somebody asked us if Brief was on YouTube, and so we searched it, and we saw a couple of them on YouTube. And then I saw all these other videos called Brief but Spectacular on YouTube, and I was like, "What is this? And I clicked them, and there are hundreds of user-generated videos from people around the country going and saying,
doing their
everything.
Version.
And I was like, "There you go, Sarah Just." And I was like, "I don't know." I'd love to take credit for these videos, but we didn't shoot these. These aren't ours. That has been one of the unintended consequences.
Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
Beautiful, yeah.
Steve, may I say something?
Of course.
She is a hard act to follow.
So are you.
Flossy forever.
So are you.
But the world is hers. My world is passing. Her world is coming. And I think most of us realize that, and we will accept it gratefully and graciously, I trust.
Ooh, Flossy.
If there are more audience questions, please feel free to write them down and bring them up, because we'll start getting to more of them in a moment. I love that girls are sending you their videos, because one of the things that I have been thinking about and has been sort of bothering me lately is that we have had a lot of talk of empowerment. Mm-hmm. And I want to know, how are we going to get from empowerment to actual power? Mm-hmm. And what is that bridge? And how do we actually make change with the momentum that is being created around all these issues that we're tackling around racism and sexism and ageism and agerism? Mm-hmm. Fill in the blank.
I think mentorship is key. I also think the young people, they have it on lock. They know, like, this, the verbiage is changing so drastically and so quickly. Oftentimes, there is little grace, right, when you're learning and relearning. But the young people have a great idea of the way in which we're going. And I'm talking high school, y'all. I'm talking middle school. Just talking to young people about like pronoun use and racial epithets. They are on it, and they're super empathetic, they're super compassionate, and they're ready to like fight for what's right, which I think for some reason there was this lull. I don't know what it is. Maybe it was like reality TV, which I love. Like, I just want people to know, like, I'm here for all of it, but it's anthropological research.
It's not real, you know that.
It's research. Okay. But I don't know when the disconnect happened, whether it was like money, whether it was, you know, the crack epidemic, and then of course the generations that it affected. But like right now, like the time is now, and the youth, the young people who are writing and speaking and protesting, they have it on lock. So I think the power is already in their hands. It requires younger teachers to really just like show them the way, like open the door, make sure the door is open, right? Like Game of Thrones, hold the door. Like, we supposed to do that. That is our job. Not like,
yeah.
Thank you. Not fight them on like respectability, yeah. Not fight them on civility. Like, mm-hmm. that doesn't matter when you're trying to get free. Mm-hmm. When you're trying to liberate a people, civility ain't gonna work.
Yeah. So there is another question here about how can, and maybe this is for Flossy too, how can we use poetry? I want to get the question exactly right. Now I can't find it. But what poet, did you see it? Which poet should we turn to feel like we can take their words and turn them into action? Who will inspire us to do that?
Let's talk about gender issues or relationship between men and women. I think we start with some of the old-fashioned stuff. We get to start with how Shakespeare treats men and women in love. Hmm. We dare to start with Romeo and Juliet. And we dare to see how equal their relationship is and how much they're hemmed in by a society that won't let them love. But I think that language itself can be liberated. I know that sounds like a lot of malarkey, but it has worked for me. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I would teach Romeo and Juliet and I would let the kids take over and they would do the balcony scene and I would have to separate them with hot water.
I mean, like while they were kissing? What
were they doing? You know, they don't kiss in the balcony scene, but my kids did.
Somehow I knew this. I don't know. I wasn't there.
Can I tell you, one thing I've learned from Flossie rewatching the video just now with you? The scene in the cab. I'm so terrified in that car ride. I don't know if you know that. Because I'll remind you, it was raining. I was worried about transportation. And I was worried the kids weren't going to show up. And I was worried that I was going to have wasted your time. And I was petrified in that car ride. And I remember there's a lot of silence. And I looked to you and I said, this is what you were wearing, actually. And I said, this is a beautiful whatever. And you said, don't make small talk. But it tells you everything you need to know about Flossie, because it's the power of intention. Mm. When I called her even the other day and I said, you know, you've reached a million people, it just ran on news every Friday night. And I said, and the comment that keeps coming up is you inspire people and you remind them of teachers in their life. Mm. And instead, you just said, let me internalize that. Let me think about that. And I thought that, you know, how often do we do that in the rapid form of communication or Twitter? How often do we just sit and think about what was just said? Mm-hmm. And so I've learned that from you. So thank you.
Yeah. Let's see what I have learned from you.
Oh, the goddess. Wrap it up.
But a goniff is always lovable. Don't use that term unless you care deeply for that person.
Flossie called me a goniff.
Yes, a goniff.
Crook, thief in Yiddish. And I said, but you said, because you steal my heart. That's what you said. I was so glad you said it because I was worried about that one.
You didn't know this was actually a conversation about love, did you? Yeah. That's actually really what it's all about. So Flossie, I want to get back to this question that is so hard to talk about, which is the growing old and growing old with grace, as you put it in your brief but spectacular story. How do you prioritize your time? How do you decide what you want to do each day as you think about the time you
have? If you live in a retirement, if you live in, I'm not supposed to mention names, but if you live in a retirement community, there are activities. You can participate, you can sit, and if you sit, invariably, you will fall asleep. But if you take an active part, we have a poetry class every Monday, and I work with the activity director, Liz Chamish, and we have a topic, a theme, and we have anywhere from 10 to 15 old ladies and some gentlemen who go back to find a poem that illustrates that theme, and if they can't, maybe they start writing themselves, mm-hmm. and that's something mm-hmm. to see mm-hmm. at age 80 and 90 and getting up there.
That's part of the film that we didn't show, which includes we were there for one of those poetry sessions, and it was unforgettable. And Flossie took a back seat to that one and really let the other residents shine.
And were they ever good? And there was Hugh Richmond, who was dying of pancreatic cancer and said very clearly, I've had a good life. I'm ready to go. Mm-hmm. And he, knowing that he would be dead in a few more days because, guess what, his doctors had given him permission, he could stand up and read Ogden Nash, Robert Frost, and make the room shake. Mm-hmm. He hadn't gotten yet close to, how shall I say, Derek Walcott, for example, whose poetry he would have loved to, or Langston Hughes, or Gwendolyn Brooks, or some of the other guys and girls.
We are recording this, so if you want to go back and write down all the poets that have been mentioned tonight, I recommend it. And actually, this brings us to another audience question, which, and I apologize, the original question was for Mahogany, which is, how can we all learn to use poetry to get through hard times?
How can we use poetry to get through hard times? I did this project, that's not what it was. We had a poetic protest responding to the police brutality, and it's called Black Poets Speak Out, and that was with Jericho Brown, Sharina Rodriguez, Amanda Johnston, John Terry Gadsden, and myself. And it was a moment where all of these artists and poets and professors were like, what are we doing? How do we respond? I feel like I'm going crazy. I feel like I don't understand. I feel silenced. I feel like I'm silencing myself. And we decided to do this initiative, which in turn still it exists, and it is an archive of poetry written by, you know, all people from 40 years ago to, you know, 2 years ago. And I learned that poetry can be the balm that we require as citizens, as global citizens, as aware citizens, as human beings. There are times when we can't articulate the frustration. We don't know yet how to process what we're feeling. It just all feels kind of jumbled, and you read the right poem, and it just kind of like clarifies. You know, the room comes becomes still. I think someone else is doing a particular project for Poetry Review or Paris Review, Sarah Kay, who introduced us.
First episode we did.
Mm-hmm. And she did this, she's doing it now, and you can find it on parisreview.com, and it's called Poetry RX. And I think the basis is you ask, someone sends in a letter, I'm having heartbreak, what do I do? And they prescribe a poem to read. And it's the specific poem, and it's really, it's such a great idea that, you know, you're in that moment of inarticulation, and you read that thing that articulates it all, and you're like, oh, I'm not alone.
Yeah.
And what does that mean, to just not be alone, to not be the only one feeling this way, and to know that there is, for lack of a better cliche, light at the other side of the tunnel. Gosh, sorry.
We're living in hard times.
I know, that was a bad one, guys. Sorry.
Right, is that right? Poets are not supposed to make bad, like those cliche metaphors.
Yeah.
Is that the problem? Okay.
I was going to blame Twitter.
No. It just gets ingrained in you. I mean, you sometimes can't help it. Dear Flossie, this has turned into an advice column. Why did you decide to get a PhD after you retired from Lowell? Your PhD classmate, Hillary. Where's Hillary? Is Hillary out there? Waving her hand? No?
Read it again, dear.
Why did you decide to get a PhD after you retired from Lowell?
Well, I'd like to answer that question. Because I was scared. The PhD for me was unfinished business. We had so many principals in the public schools, even in San Francisco, who were semi-literate as far as I was concerned. But they had their they had their EED, their doctor's degree in education. And I thought, well, I can do that. I can get a doctor's degree in education. I've been a teacher for a long time. But I took my sabbatical years at Cal, and since I was a teacher of English, I got to work with some of the loveliest, greatest people I've ever known in my life. And in my first sabbatical year, I met Professor Alex Werdling, who died very recently, and who opened my eyes to what the English language was all about. And in his class, when I was already an experienced teacher, he gave me my first real taste of George Orwell, which wasn't 1984, but which was Politics and the English Language. And that made me a teacher, that I could see how you could lie, how you could twist, how you could kill with language. And even though I killed some of my kids by making them avoid the passive voice, it became, I had something to hold on to. And when I became disillusioned with the courses in education, I had by that time become something of a writer. I had some short stories published, and I found that I wanted the PhD in English, and I thought that when I had finished my work as a teacher in high school, I would go back as a student, and those were some of the richest years in my life. Mm. That's why I waited. I wasn't sure of myself, and when I was a little more certain, then I could take on the rigors of the PhD at UC Berkeley. And let me tell you, it was not easy. Even though I was a high school teacher, I'd get my composition slashed the way only the profs could do it.
They're hardest on the good students, you know. You may have heard that.
Taught me a lesson in humility, too.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you, Flossie, Mahogany, and Steve, for joining us all this evening. I'm Lauren Schiller from Inflection Point, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.